You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast focused on the modern format. Each week, we go deep on designing spicy new decks geared at tournament play. We put our creations to the test in competitive leagues and share our findings on the air. If you would like to support Faithless Brewing, please give us your feedback to help us grow and improve the show. You can find us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG or on the Modern subreddit at r/ModernMagic. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Back to episode 4 of Faithless Brewing. I am joined as always by Dan Schriever. He is Cave Dan Online. Dan, how's it going?
I'm doing well, David. How are you?
Good. Also here with Damon Alexander. Damon, how are you?
Yeah, doing great. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you. Last week, we took a pretty deep dive on a lot of different shells for how you could use the new Kiora Planeswalker. I think, you know, we outlined kind of three basic shells, kind of a rockish white-green base, a blue-red kind of turbo ramp version, and then we kind of offered some varietals of that, and then I guess we were calling it like a Naya Zoo build with Ranger of Eos and 4 Vexing Devil, and we decided to take that one out for our first spin, and what were your impressions of that, Damon?
So I think we learned two things from that list. One is that Zoo feels pretty good right now. People play a lot of Planeswalkers these days, all the new ones, and just sort of slamming the cattles at them just kind of can go a long way. What we also learned was that I would say Kiora was not that great in the shell. There are just too many cards that didn't trigger it. You get opening draws that are like Vexing Devil, Kiora, some lands, and like a bolt, and you're like, what do I do with this hand? And we never really got to live the dream of, I think we just actually cast Ranger of Eos once and we're already dead on board, and we're just casting it for fun. So like the Kiora into Ranger of Eos into double Vexing Devil, just draw so many cards line just never really came up. And so the deck was actually, we did pretty well with it. We went 3-2. I just felt like the synergies with Kiora didn't really add to the Zoo list. And if we just played a stray Zoo list, we probably done even better with it.
Can you explain to me like what makes a deck a Zoo deck? I mean, I see we have Wild in the Kettle, and that is a card that we associate with Zoo, but like the rest of the shell didn't feel that Zoo-ish to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think classic Naya type of Zoo decks in Modern run some package involving like Bushwhackers and I think that like Narnim Renegade card. And they just come out of the gates a lot faster. They sometimes run, I think it's a Tarkas Command, if I'm getting the right dragon, that like bolts or adds counters or something. And they just come out of the gates really fast like that, especially with the Bushwhacker builds. And this one was kind of missing it was just not quite as low to the ground. It couldn't quite flood the board and just jam creatures at the opponent in quite the same way as I think a full-fledged Zoo list would.
Right, yeah. And I think when you're saying, like, the kind of cards I associate with Zoo are cards like Goblin Guide, you know, in the olden days, Curd Ape or Loam Lion or Monastery Swift Spear or Narnim Renegade, and then Tarmogoyf, that kind of thing, Lightning Bolt, sometimes Bushwhacker, sometimes Braintree Emissary, like, things where, like, you're just trying to add attackers every turn. And I think that we had some elements of that in this list, but not that many, right? It was just Wild in the Kettles and Vexing Devils.
Well, Pell Collector, that's a Zoo-like card.
Ooh, you've spoken the unspeakable name.
Well, I mean, I think that is the one takeaway from the first time we ran through it, the 3-2 list that Damon's referencing. We did not like Pell Collector. It didn't trigger Kiora. It, you know, it's only kind of corner case powerful if you played on turn one. I ran through another list with a quote-unquote improved version of the deck where I eliminated Pell Collector and played some other cards. And
extra Tarmogoyfs, I believe.
Yeah, I played extra Tarmogoyfs. I played Smuggler's Copter as a 2-of. In theory, just playing like better cards than Pell Collector. All those cards are much better. And due to some bad luck, but still just the deck felt really bad. I went 0-3, and it was just a very frustrating way to lose. You get so close to winning, but because you're not a real Zoo deck, you don't have the reach that they would with, you know, multiple burn spells. So yeah, I was just off the deck. Even the one time I had the Birds of Paradise on turn one and a Kiora in my hand with two Vexing Devils, and I just never drew my third land. So obviously that's not the deck's fault. But even the one time it was going to be sweet, I was just going to run over my opponent. I never drew the third land. So I guess I'm just off of it. My recommendation is to for everyone to lose hope and abandon that particular shell. I think Dan and Dave, you guys both pointed out every hand you open with Bird of Paradise and Wild Mikado, you just really realize that the deck is very muddled. It just doesn't have a clear game plan.
Yeah, I think that was what Dan was getting at with it not being true Zoo in the sense it played Birds of Paradise. And we all agree that somehow all the hands with Birds of Paradise in them felt a lot better than the hands without, which might be a good transition to our next deck. You guys have anything more to say about Zoo?
I think that I agree with Damon's statement that the one takeaway I had was that even this misbuilt like Zoo list just ran people over Wild Mikado. And I think exactly like you're saying, Damon, if people are going to be playing three mana planeswalkers that don't easily defend themselves, I actually think Zoo is a reasonable way to go. And putting a proactive clock on people that aren't proactively protecting their planeswalkers is very powerful. If you're not cluttering it up with all the cards we try to jam in there, I think that's a very reasonable way to attack this format.
Yeah, I'm also I'm ready to just give up on that particular list, but I think the idea of using Ranger of Eos as your fuel post-Kiora wasn't the worst idea. It wasn't crazy, because I think one of the things that we would continue to find through our testing is that, you know, Kiora is most impressive when you play her before your other creatures, and, you know, Ranger of Eos, if you are so fortunate as to draw that after Kiora, you can then use it to, like, have a steady stream of creatures to play.
The problem, though, right, is that only Vexing Devil is a one drop with four power, and
right.
The other thing we learned, I mean, Vexing Devil is just not a modern powerful card. I mean, I just don't think it's there on power level. So, but yeah, so okay, that list didn't work out, but luckily we had a lot of other options. We sort of talked about a turbo ramp with, you know, up to 12 pieces of one mana acceleration. And then we were kind of debating about various shells that could go in. We were talking about maybe more of a mid-range with a Domri Raid or two. I think, Damon, you played the first version of that list, and you were quite impressed with the exert mechanic that Dan was able to explain to us last week. can you kind of talk about your experience? You know, you kind of built the first version, and then you started making some tweaks. So do you kind of want to just talk about that?
Yeah, so what we started off with was the idea of the ramp Kiora idea in probably in either Timur or red-green colors. And rather than kind of brew from the ground up, I wanted to start with a red-green Ponza shell, which is a fringe deck in Modern, occasionally spikes a tournament, or makes top eight, which means that the deck at least has something going for it. And so we basically took the shell and said that, okay, well, first if we want to put Kiora in here, and then maybe we can just actually cut all of the land destruction except for the Blood Moons, and put in things that work with Kiora pretty well. And the cards that those decks tend to play are things like Inferno Titan and Tireless Tracker and Bloodbraid Elves. And you can't really play way too many Inferno Titans for both A, you can only play four of them, and B, that would be way too many Inferno Titans. And then Tracker and Bloodbraid don't trigger Kiora. And so the card we started looking towards was some of the hasty five CMC dragons, namely Glorybringer, Thundermaw Hellkite, and Stormbreath Dragon. And I have to say, the more we play with Glorybringer, the better and better it felt. That card is just amazing. It comes down and it kills their dude, and then it can swing at a planeswalker, so all the, you know, Narsets and Teferis out there just eat it to Glorybringer. It triggers Kiora, so all of a sudden it's like getting extra value. And, like, for example, have you ever cast two Glorybringers in one turn to take out a primetime? I have now. That was quite an experience.
I thought you were just telling a cute story, but then I played the list and I did it too. I've also done that now. It feels amazing.
Join the club. yeah, and so we started to switch over to a heavier Glorybringer build, which actually was really nice, because what we learned is that with Kiora, you really just don't want to be running four Lightning Bolts if you can. They just don't work with Kiora that well. Whereas Glorybringer can functionally do all the same things. You use Bolt to either A, kill a Planeswalker, B, kill a creature, C, kill your opponent, and Glorybringer actually just does all of those. And so that made the red-green list feel really, really well-tuned as a result. And then Blood Moon also felt like a pretty good card these days. We played a couple Gruul Spellbreakers, which felt pretty flexible. Also Hasty, able to, you know, come down and smack their Teferi or whatever. We played a Varix Bladewing, which is an interesting 4 CMC 4/4 dragon with an option to kick. and when you kick it, you get another 4/4 dragon, and it didn't come up too much, but we did that once and drew two cards with Kiora, and it felt great on turn three, I think.
On turn three.
Yeah, against blue-white control. We played against blue-white control twice, so in one league, and that was just smooth sailing. Dan, you want to talk about that league? That was the best league we had with the deck?
Yeah, so that league, we ended up 5-0-ing, and I think, if you're looking at the Tuesday deck dump, we're recording this on Monday night, but I guess you'll probably be listening on Tuesday, so you can check this deck list out. It should be published tomorrow. And we actually had a lot of...
similar list.
Yeah, it's possible.
20 cards.
If someone was so
inspired. We were getting a lot... There's some salt in the chat, I noticed, so I don't think anyone else is running a similar list.
We had some really
our opponents
really nice matches.
20 calls with Meddling Mage, we'll just say.
They didn't know which dragon to name.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, we played a couple of humans decks, played a couple of blue-white decks, and then we played one of these mono-red Karn Prison decks. And I mean, the deck just felt like really, really smooth. I think the changes, that they were slight changes, but just increasing the number of turn one mana plays, we were up to 11 in this configuration. So
let's talk about some of the variations that we've gone through. So, the original shell I proposed had 12. Damon, I think you played 10. Dan, you played 11. I mean, obviously, those are pretty minor changes. At 4, Dan, you played 4 Bloodbraid Elves, which I recommended. Damon, you did not like that card. You were pointing to some of the weaker hits we had with Cascade. And then, Damon, you were playing a little bit more of the Sarkhan, the 3-mana Sarkhan.
Yeah, at first I didn't really like Sarkhan Fireblood, and then I started playing him in the list. And you just feel like a pretty good, if you go turn one Birds into turn two Sarkhan, then you can like loot away your extra Birds of Paradise or whatever, and then ramp out your dragon on turn three. And then once you've ramped out the dragon, you can just sort of keep using his rummaging effect, technically. We did actually live the dream once of ultimating Sarkhan with Kiora out. It was pretty sweet. We drew a lot of cards.
Yes.
we had virtual high fives all around at that point.
take a screenshot before the inevitable Supreme Verdict is cast next turn.
Yeah.
Which happened.
Yeah,
but we still won with all those cards that we drew. So
Tyler's Tracker was a good card, even though it's not the best Kiora hit, just because it kind of does something similar to Kiora to kind of give you more of that mid-range grindy aspect for those matchups where that's important. And then what card I want to talk about?
Well, I want to ask Dan about one. He did not play as many Sarkhans as you did. He is in love with this other 3-mana Planeswalker. Dan, do you want to kind of take a moment here to talk up Domri, Anarch of Bolas?
Oh, I love that card. I think that was one of my overperformers from this list. Glorybringer was probably the best card in the list. I would have called Domri like the second best card in the list, at least based on the leagues that we ran with this. So Domri has like four modes that are all relevant, which is kind of crazy for a 3-mana Planeswalker, right? He gives like a static +1/+0 to your team, which, that's always nice, like, in general, but like here we have all these mana guys that suddenly become 2-power mana guys, or like Birds of Paradise becomes a 1/1 flyer. Bloodbraid Elf suddenly becomes a 4/2 haste, which can now, attack through a thing in the ice, it can fight a thing in the ice. If you have Kiora and Domri in play, now you're triggering Kiora off of your Tireless Tracker and your Bloodbraid Elf. And the fight ability, the -2, it just did so much work in, as Damon was saying, like we're trying to like move away from lightning bolts because that's not synergistic anymore with the creature package. And Domri was able to sort of pick up that slack of having interaction in conjunction with Glorybringer. And then of course the fourth ability is just he makes your stuff uncounterable, which I think blue-white is getting a lot of traction these days. It's looking better and better, and I'm facing it more and more in the leagues. So I was very happy with him. We had 2, I think, in the 5-0 list, and I would be consider going to 3. I know that Damon, you weren't quite as happy with him, but I was surprised to hear that because I loved him.
I do want to say one corner case interaction that came up a couple of times is we played a turn 1 mana accelerator. I think it was a Bird of Paradise in the case. You could play Domri on 2, and now that your bird has 1 power, it can fight your opponent's Noble Hierarch. So it is actually a 3-mana ramp spell that is also a removal spell in sort of the mirror matches, if you will, for other 1-mana ramp spells. That is an absolutely insane interaction that I never even considered. The one thing we did find, and I think everyone would agree, is you can't play 4 Kiora, so you need a different 3-mana play to help your ramp plan. You want to go from 1 to 3 to 5, but 4 QRS always felt like too many. I think we're all in agreement on that. So you need to have a Sarkhan or a Domri or whatever, you know, what have you, to kind of take you that next level. And 4 QRS really do get cluttered in the hand.
Yeah. If you ever open a hand and you have 3 QRS in it, you'll understand why playing 4 is maybe not the best idea.
Yeah. And the QRS typically were not getting attacked. So, I mean, that it's sticking around. It's not like a Jace where it can actually win the game by itself. And so it dies, and a second Jace is actually useful. I think it was very rare for QR to leave play once it came into play.
Yeah, fun fact that Dave and I both observed after playing with Kiora a fair amount is that Kiora basically has, you can just model it as infinite loyalty. I never played it and used it to untap things 7 times. I never played it and had the opponent attack it. It just somehow is just not something that happens.
And I think it's actually correct to not attack it. The times when it was attacked, and I played kind of a little more meme-ish white-green list with 4 Baylos because we kind of wanted to like push the envelope on that. When people did attack it, it just gave me more turns than I felt like I deserved. Like, they could have easily killed me instead. So I guess my statement to the kids out there is it's probably okay to let them draw a card a turn unless, you know, you have a specific, you know, 2-mana instant or sorcery that's killing Kiora. It's not worth doing 6 or 7 damage.
Yeah. Oh, and one thing, just to be clear, Dave is talking about the Baylos of the Rampaging type, not the Obstinate type.
Yes. Yeah, so we had kind of talked about...
After you, I insist.
We had talked about, you know, maybe playing, like Damon had said, the Red Titan, and then we had said, oh, you know, actually Rampaging Baylos is great with Kiora, and it was a little kiddish. I think we weren't that serious about this possibly being that good, but, you know, the 1-3-5 ramp is very real. It's quite achievable. The 6 drop for the Red Titan, I am a little open to, but the 7 drop functionally, which is what Rampaging Baylos is, and it's a 7 drop, you have to have that land. We just can't countenance that. I mean, I think the White Oketra list that I played had some possibilities, but I don't think that Rampaging Baylos should seriously be considered. So we've tried
it. It's not a 7 drop, it's a 6 drop. That's okay. You don't have to trigger it right away.
A 6 mana, 6/6 trample with no other abilities is not playable.
Well, it draws you a card.
If you have Kiora in play.
Sure. That's the whole point.
I mean, you
I both agree with Dave. We did actually try it once. And I have to say, playing a Fetch Land out with a Rampaging Baylos and Kiora out just feels great. I mean, you draw 2 cards and make 2/4/4 is like, sign me up. But ultimately, it just felt a little bit better to go with the 5 CMC Hasty Dragons.
You know, we're already kind of not the most interactive deck. And so I think you really need to discipline yourself from getting a little too cute with some of these options. I think the 5 mana dragons, especially because you want to have a big creature in play to use your Domri, let's say, you really get paid off by casting multiple creatures over the course of a game as opposed to kind of saving up for that one big play.
So, yeah, I think that it's worth sort of recapping a little more what we've discovered from the red-green shell specifically, because I feel like this list actually became quite good. Actually, our overall record with it was quite good. And that includes even some matches where I had taken it through one league where I had 3 Rampaging Baylos because I wanted to believe in that card. It just didn't work out for all the reasons you were saying. But I think what I learned through the process was that the curve that we needed was, like, you really can't keep a hand that doesn't have a 1-mana accelerator and then a 3 drop. And so I know that you were saying, you know, 12 versus 10 versus 11, Dave, it's a small difference, but I think philosophically it's a big difference. Like, the Ponza decks, they play usually 10, right? 4 Arbor Elf, 4 Utopia Sprawl, and then maybe 2 birds, with the option to side those out when the matchup calls for more removal. And I think that, like, 12 felt closer to correct than 10, based on the different iterations that I feel like I tried. Like, I always wanted every hand to start with an accelerator and then ideally even play either Kiora or Domri on 3 and then another 1-mana play. And I think that the list that we ended up 5-0-ing with did not play any 2-mana spells at all. Like, it was all 1s, it was all 3s, and then, you know, you have your 4s and your 5s. And Bloodbraid was the only 4. I think the reason...
Except for 1 Varix.
Well, he's a 7. I didn't ever want to cast that guy for 4.
But, you do, that's the whole point.
Well, you can, that's the point.
I think that once you commit yourself to that curve, like, you a couple things sort of has a cascading effect on the rest of the deck. So, like, you need your other cards to, like, be value hits. And so, like, the Blood Braids Like, you know, they don't quite fit with the rest of the deck, but like we are playing a lot of threes, so the Obliterates have a good chance of hitting a three mana spell or a Utopia Sprawl, which is fine. We need mana. And, you know, they'll get you your card. You know, that's, I think, the strength of Bloodbraid is becoming more apparent the more these counterspell decks are popping up. And secondly, Tireless Tracker, which is a card that I think last week I was down on Tireless Tracker, and I was thinking, you know, Kiora appeals to me as a card draw engine that we can play instead of Tireless Tracker. Tireless Tracker suddenly becomes very good when you have all this mana to work with. I think we played two in our last list, and we consider going up to three. I would anyway. Because, you know, you want to just get paid on your... the remaining slots in your deck, right? If you're thinking we have, you know, 11 one mana accelerators plus another five or six planeswalkers on three that add more mana, that's a lot of mana. So you need the rest of your deck to just like be that interaction that also synergizes with the planeswalkers. So moving away from things like Lightning Bolt towards things like Glorybringer, and then just having like good value out of cards like Bloodbraid and Tireless Tracker, I think became very important.
And the other appeal for me is the Bloodbraid Elf appeal, and I'll let you speak after this, Damon, is the haste. I mean, we played against a ton of Planeswalkers lists. There are Karns and Teferis and Jaces. I mean, they are all over the queues, and you have to be able to attack them. I mean, we had the classic. They played Jace. We played Bloodbraid into the Gruul Spellbreaker and killed it. I mean, you have to be doing something aggressive against a Planeswalker list. And not that Bloodbraid Elf is the answer necessarily, but haste is very real. It's real on the dragons, and it's to a lesser extent real on Bloodbraid as well. Go ahead, Damon.
Yeah, what I was going to say was haste felt very good right now. Flying haste felt even better, and Glorybringer felt even like the best. In addition to all of the excellent points that you guys made about the mana curve and the mana dorks and the three-drop planeswalkers, Blood Moon also, we didn't really talk about that much, but that felt pretty good right now to be running four of those main deck. It just kind of cleans up a lot of matchups that this deck has trouble with and adds a layer of interaction that otherwise would be difficult to handle with dragons.
On the haste
point. I'm kind of two minds on the Blood Moons, actually. I didn't like them. Maybe it was the matchups we played. I never wanted four. It felt like it was always one of the first couple cards we cited out. So I think you could maybe get away with two and then the other two in the board or something like that. That's just me. If there's going to be a lot of these mono red prison decks that are trying to play Blood Moon themselves, blue white plays a lot of basics. Blood Moon can get them, sometimes it can't. You know, I would maybe move towards the Tireless Tracker, more Tireless Trackers, if I had to iterate on the list that you guys are going to see tomorrow night with the 5-0 deck done.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about what is the role of Blood Moon in the deck. And I'm not quite sure I understand it myself. I remember, Damon, we were initially drawing it up, and you suggested playing Blood Moon plus Land Destruction. And I said, well, that doesn't seem right. Let's just keep the Blood Moons by itself. And I'm still not sure like how important they are. They were good in every matchup. I think they're just like a good turn two play against the format. They won't win the game necessarily. We don't need them to. We just need them to be a good turn two play because we have so many one mana accelerators that can let us play a strong three drop. And I just against the field, Blood Moon is a strong three drop. So I think I'd still stick with a minimum of three in the main deck and possibly four. But yeah, as Dave was saying, I think it's right to side them out when the matchup calls for it. So yeah, I think my take on the red-green is that like this is actually quite good, this deck. And if I were taking it, if I had a big tournament coming up, which I guess I do in a couple of weeks, I would consider playing some version of this if we tune out a little bit further.
And I would just like to say in this 5-0 list, and I hope you guys will correct me if I'm wrong, we literally never untapped the Exert Dragon with Kiora a single time. Like this is not Magic Christmas Land. Literally just play it on turn three or four and kill a creature with your Exert, and even if it stays tapped. I don't think we untapped it a single time with Kiora. That was great. You don't have to, you know, have all the things line up and get to exert every turn for this card to be amazing. Is that a fair statement in the 5-0 league at least?
Yeah, Glorybringer is just a great magic card, I think.
Yeah. You can still
just FTK plus kill a planeswalker or four to them, that is an insane play. And if it draws a card, then yeah, that's just too good.
Dormer can still fight with the Glorybringer even when it's exerted, which
yeah, we did that a few times. Yeah. All right, so I think we've kind of iterated to a place that's reasonable. You know, there's a few slots that are kind of up for grabs. You know, Sarkhan, do you want to play Bloodbraid Elf? How many Blood Moons do you want to play? How many one-drop accelerators? You know, I think there's kind of preferences and metagames for each of those kind of configurations. We had a few other kind of lists that we wanted to explore. Damon, I think you took kind of a white green black list with 4 Siege Rhino through a league. Do you want to talk about your experience with that?
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit in the previous week, this green-white little kid or an Abzan little kid version featuring some mana dorks, Knight of the Reliquaries, Siege Rhinos, Wildleaf Liege, which is a 4-mana 4/4 that pumps up your green-white dudes by +2/+2, which is pretty big. A Lone Sigarda, an Elesh Norn I never ever cast, 3 Kiora, and then kind of some classic Abzan interactive cards like Pushes and Inquisitions and Thoughtseizes and Abrupt Decay, etc. I took it through a league. I went 3-2. I had a sweet play where my opponent Thoughtseize my Wildleaf Liege. I still don't know why, but I wound up winning that game. And the deck felt pretty good. Siege Rhino was just kind of a house. Sometimes you just draw like a Siege Rhino and you play it, and then the next turn you untap and you draw a Siege Rhino and you play it. The next half you untap and draw and you play a Siege Rhino and you play it. And you tend to win those games. It just kind of grinds people down really fast. I played against humans and it felt good. I played against Death Shadow. It felt iffy but doable. I felt like this was pretty good. It didn't quite gel with Kiora enough just because there wasn't kind of what I would call the Glorybringer equivalent that can both be a 4-power creature and kill other creatures. And so you have to play all these pushes and paths. And Kiora just doesn't work with those cards that well. And so this deck just felt like sometimes you have a Kiora and it doesn't do anything for you. And that felt pretty bad.
So let me ask you about this list, Damon. So if I'm seeing this right, you were playing seven... You had a lot of 1-mana plays. 7 of them were accelerators, but then you also had stuff like Inquisition, Thoughtseize, Path, and Push. So when you were looking at your opening hand, like if it didn't have a 1-mana accelerator in it, did it still feel like a reasonable hand because you had an interaction? Or?
Yeah, you can go turn 1, discard, turn 2, kill, turn 3, Knight of the Reliquary or Kiora or something. It felt okay. I just felt like there wasn't room to play a lot more of the ramp-type cards. But yeah, I think that you're right that this is it's not great. This was a weak part of the deck.
I think that coming off the red-green list and the leagues we played with it, I would look at this Abzan shell and think, oh, this is just too many spells. Like, there's not enough creatures in here to make Kiora like worth featuring in this deck.
I think that is the one takeaway, is you need to play some amount of Kioras if you want to try to use Kiora, and then you need to play a certain amount of creatures beyond that. And like Damon is saying, if those creatures don't also serve a function like Glorybringer, then you're forced to play spells to perform that function, and then you're really diluting your sort of Kiora value, to coin a phrase.
Yeah, it was interesting playing this deck after playing the red-green dragons list. It was a good counterpoint to really kind of highlight what was good about the dragons list. And so that was very interesting. I do think that some of the cards here are good. I mean, Seedrenal felt pretty good in a lot of the matchups. Wildleaf Liege actually was interesting with just all these, red, white, green cards. Knight of the Reliquary just got huge really fast with Wildleaf Liege. You just can get this beatdown plan going. So I think this sort of Abzan shell might have legs, just I don't think Kiora would play a part in it.
And I will say one thing I noticed, and I ran like a white, green kind of version of the red, green list we're talking about, but I played Oketra on top to try to, every time you cast a creature, it sort of turns all your mana creatures into hits for Kiora. I did not like the Rampaging Baelos, but a card that was a little polarizing is Knight of the Reliquary. A lot of times you play it and you feel like you have to use it a couple times before you can even attack, but with Kiora, it kind of supercharges that timeline. You get an activation of the knight, and you can attack that turn, or additionally, it is a cheap creature that triggers Kiora. So I think those two cards interacting is powerful. But yeah, maybe if you want to play a little bit more value, if you're wanting to play Thoughtseize, then I think Kiora starts to be less attractive.
So a question that I would have for you guys from your experience, like when you have both Kiora and another 3-mana play in your hand, like Knight of Reliquary or Anafenza or whatever it is, like do you feel like you know which one you want to play first? Like obviously, ideally, we want to play Kiora first to get that card, but did you feel like that was often a source of tension?
Not really, in the sense that I think with Knight, you just want to get online as fast as possible. And frequently, before you started using the Knight, it won't always be a 4-4 if you only have a single fetch land to go with it. And as a result, I feel like the tension was mostly just, oh, you just play the Knight first, in my experience.
I guess your question's too open-ended for me to answer. I think most of the time, like 90% of the time, Damon's right, but if they have mana up and they're a removal heavy deck, then like playing Kiora and wasting their Fatal Push feels amazing, or Lightning Bolt or whatever. Is the matchup a race? Then you need Knight Online. Is it going to be more about value? Then you want Kiora. So it is very dependent. I think in general, because QR can come down after night and kind of start the turbocharging process, that's totally, you know, that's the default play 90-95% of the time.
Can I also ask you, Dave, about so in this green white list that you're referencing, I believe the concept was to feature rampaging Beloths, and to the extent that you're also playing Lotus Cobra to try to get there faster.
Yeah.
But did you ever execute that? Like, was that a good payoff, or was it just too complicated?
The one time we did it against Mardu Pyromancer, it legitimately did feel amazing. I mean, we triggered, we played fetch lands like multiple turns in a row, and then another reliquary, and then we fetched up the +1/+1 counter land, and I mean we had like 50 power in play. But I think it's one of those cards where you really remember the one time, it's just so sweet. You know, it's like, oh, God, this card's amazing. And then there were so many times against Jund or like blue-black control where it just rotted in my hand and Liliana took enough lands. I never even got to six in the first place.
You're watching your mana creatures die one by one and you're farther and farther away from six
lands.
I was
definitely impressed with Oketra turning like late-game Birds of Paradise and Lotus Cobras into value. And I think there's something there. I had enough time to kind of iterate that to where I'd want it to be. And I think there's still weaknesses because you don't get to play these sweet sort of interactive dragons. But I was very impressed by, once Oketra's in play, her ability to dominate the board. And when you start drawing two or three cards a turn from Kiora, that is getting to the point where like any deck that isn't combo killing, you cannot compete.
Yeah, Oketra's a super interesting card that I just completely glossed over as something for Modern. I was playing Standard, I think, yesterday, and I just got absolutely obliterated by Oketra. And now I'm wondering if I should be listening to you more about this card. What intrigues me about it is that it kind of wants something similar to Kiora in the sense that, yeah, you want to play it and then still have more creatures to follow up with. And which makes me wonder if Ranger of Eos still has a home in some like twist on the deck. Maybe not with the Vexing Devils, but just sort of if you want to follow up an Oketra with stuff, right? You have Ranger of Eos, you have Squadron Hawk, maybe like some sort of murder proc type shell with Oketra on top could add sort of another power line of attack to that kind of strategy.
I would have thought it was ridiculous, but like with how quickly it takes over like the actual board, now can you build in enough interaction to not die to all the powerful things that are happening in Modern while that's happening? That's the open question to me, but if you can cast Oketra on turn three a reasonable amount of the time and follow it up with like two drops that do anything at all, you are in an insane position. So,
to some extent, the list Dan is mentioning sounds kind of like a mono-white martyr build featuring Oketra, which sounds interesting to me. I mean, I think mono-white martyr has never been like a truly great Modern deck, but it's always kind of been there. And I took it through a league once. I had fun with it. It felt decent. It has pretty polarizing matchups. The famous, 95% matchup against Burn. But yeah, I have to wonder if Oketra could really help shore up some of the control matchups.
Yeah, Murder Proc or whatever it's called, that deck doesn't even play very many Proclamation of Rebirth anymore. But Mono White Murder has been like pretty sneakily well positioned for the past few months. I think I played a league with it like a month ago, and I almost 5-0'd. I lost the mirror match in round five because he was more experienced with timing me out. that's a very interesting deck to play online because timeouts are very real when you're involved in a Murder Proc match. So yeah, if you're adding Oketra, you might want to look at a list that maybe accelerates a little more and doesn't play as many Wrath effects. And honestly, that might be just more versatile against the field. Like, I never liked how that deck had to play four Wrath of Gods in the main deck. So that's something to keep on the back burner, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. And I know you, Dan, tried a couple other, sort of variants to try to use Kiora. You played like a red-green Eldrazi Dragon list.
Yeah, these are just two. I tried a red-green and a black-green version of this, and this was after we had sort of done our explorations with the red-green dragon ramp. And I felt like one of the takeaways that I had from that was that I wanted to push all my interaction onto large creatures like Glorybringer. So the first update I tried was to keep that Glorybringer shell with like all the one mana accelerators, Kiora and Domri and Glorybringer, but then use the rest of the slots on even more large interactions. So Thought Not Seer was the other sort of big interactive monster that like has Modern pedigree. So I added four Eldrazi Temple, I added four Thought Not Seer, and I added some Reality Smashers, and the cards that those replaced were the other dragons, the Stormbreath Dragons, or the Thundermaw Hellkites, and the Bloodbraid Elves. Actually, I had to cut the Blood Moons because, you know, once you're playing Eldrazi, you can no longer afford to turn off your colorless lands like that.
Makes sense.
And the curve felt more or less the same. I said this will be an easy 4-1. I think, Damon, you're watching me. I almost got there. I got a little bit unlucky against one of the matchups. But yeah, I think it went 3-2. And the deck felt like the curve was correct. The plan felt a little bit less good against the field than just the Blood Moon, Tireless Tracker, the Bloodbraid Elf one, because I think that ended up just being a very versatile package, resilient versatile package, when you have a ways to just sort of mess with them in different ways and present multiple threats out of a single card like Bloodbraid. So putting more of my eggs into a single Eldrazi basket, just yeah, it was good. It wasn't bad, but it didn't feel like it was better to me.
Just an exploration to everybody at home. So because Kira can untap any permanent, this gives her another avenue to tap for an extra 2 mana if she untaps Eldrazi Temple, right, Dan?
Right, exactly, yeah. So I took that just did one leak with that one, and then sort of left it aside as a slightly worse version of the red-green dragons. And the second list that was a spin-off of that was, or sticking with the Thought Not Seer plan, I felt like we hadn't given Tarmogoyf enough chances to like be like the featured 4-power creature to trigger in Kiora. So I threw together a black-green list that my Kiora triggers were Tarmogoyf, Grimflayer, Thought Not Seer, and then a couple of Reality Smashers. And in order to I think maybe that was 14 creatures. And in order to have sort of virtual more copies, I had 4 Traverse the Ovenwalds. So this ended up being kind of a Delirium shell to, you know, give me my lands. But then like once I got to my end game of like having a Kiora in play and trying to like hammer out a bunch of creatures in a row, I could use Traverse to have like functionally, I don't know, 18 copies of these 4-power creatures. The deck didn't quite function. I felt like I was flooding out a little bit and might have misbuilt it slightly. So that league didn't pan out. I think I went 1-3 or something like that. It didn't feel like I quite had solved the mix of spells that I needed. So I'm not quite sure like whether there was something there. There were a couple of games where I was just playing like, you know, Tarmogoyf, draw a card, Grimflayer, draw a card, Tarmogoyf, draw a card, Thought Not Seer, draw a card, just like constantly triggering. But there were other matches where it was like, I don't know, I have like a Traverse, a Fatal Push, and like eventually draw a Kiora. It just didn't feel like I knew whether I wanted to play my creatures first or my Kiora first. I think that was what motivated my question for you guys earlier. So I think that list, especially, it felt like I was playing the creatures and then playing Kiora, and it just felt a lot worse. I didn't have a card like Lurebringer or Nightly Reliquary where I could feel confident playing that and then playing a Kiora afterwards to get some value out of it.
Yeah, I think the mix of kind of threats, acceleration, etc., because you need a certain amount of hits to make Kiora worth it, is still something worth exploring. And I think there's still some shells that we haven't tried. Dan, I think last week you were saying this could be a possible addition to Mono Green Devotion. That's another list that uses the sort of Arbor Elf acceleration package. And, you know, anytime Kiora can untap for 2 mana, that's a really powerful card. That's another list that also plays big, beefy creatures. We noted that Kiora has kind of a similar effect to Temur Ascendancy. So if you wanted to maybe cut a couple Kioras, but still have multiple kind of instances of that effect, that's another way to sneak that in there. Any other, some people had mentioned maybe Bant Eldrazi, sort of a variant of what you're talking about in terms of red-green. But again, I think you're going to run into that weakness where you don't have the Glorybringer to affect the board on 5.
Oh, I'm very optimistic still about Bant Eldrazi for Kiora.
Oh, all right. Love it.
Yeah, specifically because of the card Eldrazi Displacer and Drawner of Hope. Like those two are just like great cards with Kiora. Like they will take as much mana as, well, okay, not the Drowner, but the Displacer will accept as much mana as you have to put into it.
And, great. And Kiora does definitely reward you for having a mana sink.
Yeah, this might be a win more scenario, but like, if you're ever using a Displacer to blink one of your own 4-power creatures, which does come up, I don't know, I haven't played that deck in a while. But
especially yeah. Thought Not Seer.
Yeah, that would come up if you have a Kiora in play. Like you're really doing it at that point. I think what strikes me is like a possibility for that deck is that like that deck at least understands that it wants to play the Kiora first. So I think that's one of my takeaways, is that you want to build a deck that is pretty confident in like what role it wants Kiora to play. And I think that's why I think that a Green Devotion Shell, which we didn't end up trying, but I think that would be like a good home for it. Any deck that starts with a one mana accelerator into a Kiora into something bigger, like that would probably be optimizing Kiora more so than the lists that are trying to like play these cheaper 4-power creatures that may come down before Kiora or not, and may not have a good mana sink in them.
Well said. Well, yeah, I think, yeah. You know, I think we're at a place where, you know, we found maybe a couple of homes for Kiora, maybe a couple more prospective homes if people want to try that out. Damon, do you kind of have any closing thoughts on Kiora as the behemoth beckoner as a modern playable card?
Yeah, I really do think that the Kiora and Glorybringer just really are best friends. I think that Kiora is a great play first with Glorybringer. Glorybringer will catch you right back up no matter what your opponent has done in turns, you know, 1 through 3. Glorybringer will almost always be able to sweep them up. So I must say about the Red-Green Dragons list. I agree with Dan. I would take that to a tournament soon if I had to.
All right. Yeah. Well, we're going to move from an uncommon Planeswalker to maybe some other Planeswalkers in the set that we've kind of been seeing all over the place. We've talked about seeing Teferi. The other card that I think has got a lot of attention is the new Karn. It's a 4-mana Planeswalker with 5 loyalty. And it has a passive ability, as many Planeswalkers in the set do, that activated abilities of artifacts your opponents control can't be activated. It has a +1 that says until your next turn, up to 1 target non-creature artifact becomes an artifact creature with power and toughness, each equal to its converted mana cost. It has the -2. I think that's the one that's been getting a lot of attention, which lets you choose an artifact card you own from outside the game or in exile, reveal that card, and put it into your hand. So what we've seen is some amount of Karns, I think, added to a bunch of sort of tier 1 decks. I'm specifically thinking of Amulet and Tron. And it is tutoring for Mycosynth Lattice. And Mycosynth Lattice is a 6-mana card that turns all permanents in play and all into artifacts and all cards in your hand into colorless cards. And combined with its passive ability, it is a hard lock on the game. So I think we're seeing that. You know, 1 Mycosynth Lattice and 2 or 3 Karns stapled into multiple tier 1 decks. So you guys, I think we even played against maybe one, like a mono red prison deck that played some number of Karns as well.
Yeah, Karn is everywhere right now. And it's kind of shocking to see how many different shells are just trying to throw some Karns in, because he has all these little annoying combos that you don't have to put them in your deck, right? You have to give up some sideboard slots, but... like that's fine, right? I mean, the sideboard space is valuable in Modern, but the format's so big that like you could go through an entire tournament and just like never face the matchups where you would have used those sideboard slots anyway. So like, why not use a few of them on cards that are just going to like always work with your main deck plan? So
I would take it a step further. I think that Karn actually can make your sideboard more effective by letting you play cards like Tormod's Crypt and then getting them game 1. Or in Staring Bridge or Trinisphere. This is what you'll see out of a lot of the Tron decks, is now they have access to these cards as early as turn 3 or turn 4. And if you're playing a deck like Phoenix and your opponent goes turn 3 Karn into Trinisphere, it's really hard to win that game from there.
Right, so that ends up being like a massive sort of overhaul on like how that deck is even using its sideboard. Because, you know, Trinisphere is not a card that you would find in the sideboard of a Tron deck prior to War of the Spark. Same with Tormod's Crypt. So yeah, it's a complete overhaul of the sideboard of some of these, like, I guess I'll just call them the big mana decks, Amulet and Tron. They're envisioning that like at the time they play the Karn, you know, they'll be able to like cast anything they choose to fetch out of it.
Yeah, I've heard Karn compared to sort of Stoneforge Mystic in the sense that it's sort of a 1-card win that you only need to commit, you know, sort of 5 cards maybe in your 75 to the package. Dan, I think you were saying that somebody else called it kind of a Blood Moon for big mana decks, but it's much more of a hard lock.
Yeah, that's specifically the Lattice interaction.
Yeah.
I think. So I think if it were just Amulet and Tron, I'd be like, oh, well, that's just big mana doing its thing, you know, whatever. We know how to, or we used to know how to beat those decks. And now maybe with the addition of Karn, we know we need to add some more creatures to the board. So we have some natural defenses the turn they play it. But it's not just there, right? It's also showing up in this Red Prison deck, which is, while not a big mana deck, it is a kind of cheaty fast mana deck that then tries to grind the game to a halt, and which, you know, you sort of leisurely win. And there it's actually not so much the Lattice, but it's Liquid Metal Coating, which is often the first card that they will get, because Liquid Metal Coating in conjunction with the plus ability on Karn allows you to pick off lands for free, and it can pick off any permanent with something like an Abrade. So that's another quite kind of alarming interaction that we're seeing from Karn. And I think you'll find it also in things like, I think I've seen Lantern Lists playing this. Everyone's playing Karn. So the question is, like, should we also be playing Karn? And if so, what should we be doing with him?
Yeah, so my impression when I was looking at these decks was that Karn was only good against us when we were like 75% to already lose the game. I don't think it ever saved someone that I was beating. So that made me think, what if we just lean into Karn? Karn is our plan. We're not stapling it into some tier one deck and we're presenting some alternative win condition. What if our goal is just to resolve Karn and specifically the Liquid Metal Coating interaction in our main deck? And one of the things that's drawn me to that is, or two, one, we get to play, I think, one of the better cards in Modern, which is Ancient Stirrings. It finds both Liquid Metal Coating and Karn. And two, they keep printing. I don't know if it's because they're concerned about, you know, keeping versatile answers and, you know, best of one scenarios. They keep printing really versatile ways to kill artifacts that aren't embarrassing if you don't have Liquid Metal Coating in play. You mentioned Abrade, also Culligan's Command. This is a main deckable card, and it is a insane card with Liquid Metal Coating in play. So I guess I'm proposing sort of a Jund shell where you get to play four Ancient Stirrings, you get to play three Liquid Metal Coatings in your main deck, you get to play four Karn, your fourth Liquid Metal Coating, and the Lattice are in your sideboard, and then you get to play, you know, four Abrade, four Culligan's Command. You can play some number of, you know, other interaction if you like. I'm proposing sort of some Hand Disruption, like sort of a classic Jund value shell, Inquisition, and Thoughtseize. Dissenter's Deliverance is another card that kills artifacts, so it is a Vindicate effect if you have Liquid Metal Coating, but it also cycles, so it's not dead in your hand. So I'm kind of interested in just exploring. You know, my first instinct as a deck builder is, like, push it all the way. Don't just staple it into an existing list. How far can you actually sort of push a broken interaction, if there is a broken interaction?
So we have a list in front of us that we're going to be discussing right now, and we'll be posting this list.
We'll post it for the kids.
I think it might be hard to conceptualize for someone listening, but so we're playing a lot of artifact destruction, and then the Liquid Metal Coatings, three in the main plus four Karns, which will then grab the fourth Liquid Metal Coating from the board. And then in addition to that, you have a Karn wish board, a Karn board sort of sketched out for the sideboard. So this is a really interesting deck. I think that the card that I really like is Talisman of Indulgence, because that accelerates and fixes. The card that I don't like is Liquid Metal Coating, and I'm not sure what that means for the deck. So the deck is built around it. You said we get to play three Liquid Metal Coatings, but and we're so dependent on that, given how many artifact destruction effects we're playing. Like, what happens when you just don't have it yet in your hand? And when you have, you know, you draw a Dissenter's Deliverance, okay, you can cycle it. But what if you draw a Tin Street Hooligan or whatever? That's just a 2/1. Or Reclamation Sage is just a 2/1. Are these main deckable cards in the abstract, or are these kind of best case scenario, like, if we've established our Liquid Metal Coating, then we can start killing at a slightly efficient rate any permanent. I like the Stirrings, and I like the Talisman, to sort of, like, assuming that we have found the piece where we're going to play at a reasonable point in the game, right? Like, you could potentially play Liquid Metal Coating plus kill something on turn three.
Do you have any thoughts, Damon?
Yeah, I guess when I hear the phrase Liquid Metal Jund, I think, oh, Jund, like the typical modern Jund deck. And when I looked at this, I was like, this is nothing really like the typical Jund deck. It just is Jund colors, which is actually just interesting. It points out how much that deck has kind of taken the name Jund to not really mean those colors, but that deck. But yeah, I kind of agree with Dan that if you don't have your Liquid Metal Coating, this deck does not play at all out like Jund, in the sense that it can kind of flexibly handle a lot of permanents and then win the game. Instead, it plays out like a deck that is really good at handling artifacts and enchantments and really so at handling anything else. But it is interesting. I mean, I've seen a list before Karn ever came out. It was like a budget mono green deck featuring Liquid Metal Coating and Rex Ages on MTG Goldfish. It looked interesting to me. I mean, it does seem like it's hard to say if this will be reliable enough without playing it. You do effectively have 7 copies of Liquid Metal Coating, if you think of the Karns, and then you also have 4 Ancient Stirrings, so you do have a lot of digging ability to find them. But then, of course, even when you do find them, you can only do it once a turn. So, I'm curious.
I mean, is there a way to make it that a little more consistent? Like, is there any equivalent liquid metal coating that we can plausibly play in the main deck?
You can play the, well, this does not function exactly like liquid metal coating, but you can play the 3-mana artifact 1/1 that taps to make a land an artifact until the end of turn. Yeah. But I think that card is just too weak.
Yeah. This is the Mirror Land Shaper is the one we're talking about right now.
Yeah, I don't know the name of the card.
It's in your sideboard here.
Oh, well, I knew it at some point. I don't ever remember the names of cards. I mean, the other thing this does is also, like, dominates all the Karn mirrors because they're playing a bunch of artifacts and we just get to kill them super efficiently.
I mean, I wish that were true. I think they're not playing that many artifacts. They're playing some artifacts. They're not playing a huge number, which is kind of alarming.
Yeah, and their Karn turns off our liquid metal coating.
That is very true.
And then this deck features 6 creatures, all of which have power 2 to fight down their planeswalkers.
So as a point of comparison, I think it might be useful to just pull up that Red Prison deck that we were referencing earlier that has been making some appearances. That is another one where you might encounter a main deck liquid metal coating that hasn't been Karn searched. And I think in those lists, you'll find them playing 3 or even 4 copies of a Braid. So they are like willing to, use some slots on cards that are really exciting with liquid metal coating, but it's in a restrained way. Like the rest of the deck is still what you associate with a prison strategy, like Simeon Spirit Guides, Desperate Rituals to try to land something like a Chalice of the Void or an Ensnaring Bridge or a Blood Moon. That's there. Okay, there he is, Blood Moon. So yeah, those are like the Red Prism package, and then the liquid metal coating gives you just like another way to like potentially start locking them out. So do you think that if we're just comparing these game plans side by side, I think here we're like very all in on the idea that we can suddenly start destroying their permanents, but we're not really preventing them from casting stuff. I mean, you do have some discard here, which I like. You have 3 Inquisition, 3 Thoughtseize. But apart from, I mean, we're not going to fight them in any other axes besides, you know, maybe discarding something and then trying to destroy their permanents at a slightly advantageous rate for ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. Plus you have, I'd say mediocre, but you have creature removal to actually keep your Karn free. You know, like when Tron is playing Karn, they're just playing him naked a lot of times. They don't actually have a way to block for him.
True. Well, we don't have any creatures in this list either, right? We have
a Braid. I mean, we can kill creatures is my point.
That's a good point, yeah. So 2 things that I really like about this list that are maybe not specific to liquid metal coating, but I mentioned Talisman as a card that I really like, and I think that the Talismans are underappreciated in Modern. You rarely see them in decks. For those who are not familiar with them, these are 2-mana artifacts that you tap them for a colorless, or you can tap them and take a damage to get either like a red or a green. Right? There's one
they're
for
only, Talisman. No, they're only allied color pairs, I believe.
Yeah, only allied color pairs, yeah. But they're kind of, they're mana rocks with haste. Like, they're kind of like, what are those cards? The Signets, but you can use them right away. And I think the promise that I think that they have is that, you know, Modern incentivizes a lot of 1-mana spells, but sometimes there are these sweet 4-mana spells. Like, for me, it was Experimental Frenzy was one that I spent maybe too much time trying to make work. Or that was a card where you really want to have a lot of cheap 1-mana stuff, but you also want to resolve this 4-mana important engine piece. And the Talisman was like a wonderful way to bridge to that, where I could play my 1-drops, because I had so many of them. Then on turn 2, if I had a Talisman, I could play the Talisman and still play a 1-drop. So I'm not falling behind on interacting with the board on the turn that I play my Accelerant. And then now I could potentially have 4-mana to land my 4-mana engine piece. So I think that basic structure is built into this deck as well. I think that's a very clever construction, right? Because you're playing your discard spells or your Ancient Stirrings for your 1-mana, but you're also trying to get to Karn at a reasonable turn of the game. So I think that I would I would try to retain that with whatever we end up doing with this list. And the second thing that I really liked is just Kolaghan's Command as a standalone card, which, you know, that card used to be, I don't know, what, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, just like a format staple when Mardu Pyromancer was a thing. And I think people have just sort of forgotten about it. It's still great. I mean, we were playing a couple of copies in that Niv-Mizzet Reborn control list, and it was just like a great card against the field. We didn't need any synergies with it. it was just, it's just two for ones. As many of them as you draw, you'll get your two for ones, and often like very important two for ones. So I think having four of those is a big draw to this deck for me.
Yeah, when I compare this to the kind of mono red prison deck, this deck looks like, yeah, it grinds better between the Colgan's commands and the Ancient Stirrings. Like the mono red prison decks typically are just very dependent on having a strong opening seven, blitzing with one of these troublesome permanents, and then just hoping that's good enough, and then kind of maybe anemically falling with a Karn a few turns later. This deck looks like it's a little bit able to get under the opponent with the discard and then use some of these Jund cards to control the game flow, and then ultimately in the mid game seal it up with Karn. And that's interesting to me. I think it might be a little bit more kind of fun to play. I don't really like playing the mono red prison decks. I find they're a little bit too all in for my taste.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Damon. I understand why you guys are comparing it to mono red, but this is for people who actually like to play Magic. So I mean, if you just want to look at
your opponents play Magic
and see if you win, you can do that. Sure, there's lots of decks for that in modern. I mean,
can I go on a mini rant about these decks? Do we have time for that?
Yeah.
Because I hate prison decks. I really hate them. And I know that like that's our kind of our theme for the week is these sort of planeswalker fun police cards like Teferi and Karn. But, you know, these are like they're very seductive for brewers because like prison cards are, they often have some kind of setup involved. Like, hey, if you assemble these pieces, you can do this amazing thing. You'll lock your opponent out of doing anything. And, you know, Saffron Olive, much love to him. But he's very drawn to these, you know, he loves this kind of thing. And I think a lot of people like imagining themselves assembling this total lockdown on the game. But, you know, you can build those decks, but like they're kind of miserable. They're kind of like a waste of game time, right? Like time is a precious thing. And you know, maybe you'll win the game, but you know, you didn't really play Magic. Right? It's I don't know. I mean, that's fine. That's fine. Philosophically, I'm not attracted to, I don't want to be the one like sleeving up a prison strategy because, you know, I'm here to like interact. I know maybe modern incentivizes playing these sort of lopsided, just dunk on the opponent and totally lock them out. But yeah, it just doesn't feel the same. It doesn't feel like you played a game.
Yeah. Part of it also, I think, is that like in Legacy, there's a deck show and or sneak and show. And it's similar where if you do things right, you get a turn two Emrakul with haste and then just eat the opponent alive. And the problem with that deck and these kind of prison decks is that the failure modes of these decks are just terrible. You sit there with like a Chandra, a Mountain, and then like all your stuff has died and that's it. And you're just top decking and your opponent is meanwhile like playing these fun Magic cards and they're like drawing cards with track and you sit there and you're just jealous. And so somehow like when you win, you're not really playing Magic, and when you lose, you're not playing Magic, and it's like, you know, time is precious. Play more Niv-Mizzet.
Well said. Well said. So having gone on that rant, now let's talk about some more prison strategies
that you can brew. These are not, wait a minute, these are not prison strategies.
They're lockouts, though.
Yeah. In that way, Splinter Twin is also a prison strategy, because I didn't get to play Magic after turn four anyway.
Well, I don't like that deck either.
That's fair. That's fair. A total win is not really a prison, it's just a win.
When I throw down to turn three Karn, is that a prison strategy? You tell me. I don't know. You still get to cast your spells with all these decks, by the way. I don't want to hear an argument that turn two Liquid Metal Coating is broken in Modern. That is a ridiculous statement. After I was just being mocked for putting three.
No, this is okay, this is not a prison deck, the one that you're presenting to us, right? It's more of a Jund deck. Although you do have like you have the Microsoft Lattice in the sideboard, which I think is just gonna be correct. Everyone.
Yeah, if you play Karn, you have to play Mycosynth Lattice 1 of in your sideboard. That's the deal.
Can you tell us briefly about the sort of wishboard, like what kind of cards you're thinking of?
I just kind of picked like a one of for each of the kind of decks that I'd be worried about. You know, the fourth Liquid Metal Coating, obviously, just to make it more consistent. The Lattice we already talked about. Ensnaring Bridge is a very powerful anti-aggro card. It's one of the few sort of artifact ways to catch you up if there's an excessive amount of power on your opponent's side of the board. Engineered Explosives kind of lets you deal with troublesome permanents. This deck is three color, so it's a relatively effective card. Tormod's Crypt, Nihil Spellbomb. I kind of want two, so when you can board into one, so you have one main deck, and then you still can fetch one up with Karn. I think people are kind of skimping on that when they just play the one. Piling Needle or Sorcerer's Spyglass, that's a good anti-Planeswalker card. And to Damien's point earlier, I think you do need to play some amount of ways to kill other Karns, because it's very powerful against us. A Dreadbore is the cheapest way to do it in these colors. The other thing I was thinking is decks like this, where we don't really have any creatures main, encourage people to side out their removal. So you could like sideboard into Dark Confidant and just try to kind of win like a value post-sideboard plan.
Quick question. Why is the Mirror Landshaper in the sideboard? Like, why are there two of them in the sideboard?
Well, first of all, a lot of times I'll just put cards out just as a reminder to myself that they exist. So that was just a card that I was like, oh, if they're gonna actually, if you're playing an opponent and they're expecting to take out their removal, then Mirror Landshaper just gives you a ton of consistency with your liquid metal coating if your plan is to attack lands. So like, let's say against blue white control, they take out their pass. That's a reasonable thing to do when they don't see any creatures worth killing. Then you effectively, you know, get to add some amount of liquid metal coatings. I'm using air quotes here to your deck after board. I'm not sure that that's correct, but I think it's a thought process.
So let's transition now to a second sketch that you've drawn up for us, which is not built around Karn, but it's built around Teferi Time Raveler.
Yeah, so that is a white and a blue for legendary Planeswalker Teferi. He starts with 4 loyalty. He has a passive ability that says each opponent can cast spells only anytime they could cast a sorcery. He has a +1 that until your next turn, you may cast sorcery spells as though they had flash. And then he has a -3, which is to return up to 1 target artifact, creature, or enchantment to its owner's hand, draw a card. So this has shown up as like a 1 or 2 of in a lot of like blue-white control. I think we played against it quite a bit. It's actually quite annoying against Bloodbraid Elf because it prevents you from getting to cast the spell that you cascade into since the stack is not clear. So you can cast a sorcery at that time, so it very effectively counters it. But it made me wonder if you could build a deck where you try to just silence your opponent out of the game. Silence is a 1-white instant. It says target opponent cannot cast spells this turn. And if you put silence under Isochron Scepter, then you just activate it during their upkeep if Teferi's in play, and for the rest of the game they don't get to cast any spells.
Isochron Scepter. What year is this? Yeah. Come on, old man. Isochron Scepter? Is that even modern legal?
It is modern legal. I did confirm that, at least.
All right, so this is a 2-mana artifact. You play it, you imprint, what is it, an instant, converted mana cost 2 or less, which you can then spend 2 mana to cast, you know, over and over again. You cast a copy. So that's a casual hit. You know, we used to dream about that card when we were younger. all the things we could do with it. Put a bolt on it, put a path on it, put a counterspell on it.
Like back a little fire ice table. On it.
You can put fire ice underneath it. You can't do that anymore, unfortunately, but...
This card, Teferi Time Raveler, is all over the place in Modern, and it's kind of stunningly generous on all of the lines of text. I think the fact that that minus ability, -3, actually draws a card is kind of offensive to me. Like, it doesn't need to draw a card. It's already good enough without that, and yet here it draws you a card. Where, like, the static alone is like, devastating in many matchups. So, yeah, we're seeing Teferi... You'll just run into this card no matter what format you're playing, standard, modern. I don't know if it's played in Legacy. I think the only it is, yeah. It just sort of takes I think Nassif was saying on Twitter that he doesn't like how this card takes all the skill out of the control mirrors, which it kind of does. It's extremely punishing against a deck that is hoping to play counter spells or anything at instant speed. So. Yeah, I think we haven't seen much of anyone trying to like really build around the static specifically, like apart from just sort of incidentally getting value off it. I've seen one list that was using Teferi plus Knowledge Pool, and I think this was played at a SCG Classic in Richmond to a 9th place finish, but it hasn't really got any traction since then. Knowledge Pool is a 6-mana artifact. If you have it in play, suddenly it's like a possibility storm. Every spell that's cast gets sort of added to the knowledge pool, and you instead get to cast a different spell from the knowledge pool, which is great, except when Teferi's down, you can't do it. So that's more like a hard combo, or sorry, leading hard on Teferi's static to just sort of end the game. I think what's interesting about the list that you're describing to us, Dave, is that you actually don't necessarily need Teferi to achieve this Isochron Silence lock. I mean, there's not that many ways to get out of a silence on Isochron Scepter. But you have to naturally draw an instant destruction. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So I think in that sense, like the fact that that combo is almost good enough without Teferi. Wait, let me choose different words. Not
yeah.
That combo is almost intriguing and perhaps build around worthy in the absence of Teferi. And now you're adding another piece that is strong on its own, right? Because we're seeing Teferi just as a card you can play. You can just put that in your deck as a proactive thing to do on 3 mana, and you'll get some good value out of it. You add that to the deck, and now suddenly if you happen to draw these 3 pieces at the same time, you've actually straight up won the game, like for real. You don't have to worry about them drawing a key command or whatever it is.
Well, they can attack you, right?
Yes, but Teferi bounces their creature.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really attracted to me is, you know, you plus Teferi on 3, they play, you know, they attack with a 2-drop or whatever. That's why, A, we're playing cheap removal, and B, Teferi puts things back in their hand. So he only needs to do that one time until, if the lock is established, they never get to cast that creature again.
So you're saying that on turn 2, you play your Scepter, turn 3, Teferi, bounce their 2-drop, and then...
I'm imagining we'd spend turn 1 and 2, you know, casting Remand or various, you know, Opt or Path. Turn 3, we play Teferi plus it. Turn 4, we play Scepter and then use it during their upkeep. And if Teferi's in play, they can't counter Isochron Scepter because it's our turn. And during their upkeep, they can't do anything because Teferi's in play. So if that ever happens, the game is literally over. They don't get to cast a spell for the rest of the game.
In this sketch that you've sent us, so you mentioned some of the cards, but what else sort of rounds out the deck or the list that you're imagining?
Well, if you want to play just blue-white, I think you do need to really maximize your kind of hits for Isochron Scepter. So I'm proposing 4 Silence, 4 Path to Exile, 4 Opt, and then 3 Vapor Snag as sort of an additional removal spell. I think we had talked also about maybe playing red for Lightning Bolt if you want to kind of maybe pursue a more tempo angle. Then on 2, I'm proposing 4 Isochron Scepter, 4 Snapcaster Mage, 4 Remand. And then on 3, Teferi and Vendilion Click. And then what you want to play up the chain is kind of up to your preference. I think the normal Teferi, the 3-4 Teferi, works as well with the lock. So it's probably worthwhile as a one of. I don't know if you'd want to play Cryptic Command. I mean, you can play more counter spells if you like. Maybe you want to play more like Serum Visions to find your combo. That's a possibility too.
What is the normal Teferi? You're talking about the Hero of Dominaria?
2 blue, 3-4, the original.
OG Teferi.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He also has text on him, which says that your opponents can only cast spells at times they can cast sorcery. So he, back in the day when creatures used to have static abilities that we cared about, he also has that text. So
we're dating
maybe,
ourselves
maybe here. As sort of a quote-unquote fifth Teferi Time Raveler effect.
He's so-called fifth Teferi. He's not really a Teferi, even though he is a Teferi.
So I have a question. Do you think of this deck as like a control deck or as a combo deck? Because I'm wondering about like the Cryptics and the Vendilion Clicks. These are kind of control cards to me. But I'm not sure, like without the sweepers and such, like if you can support that plan.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not. I'm sort of thinking of it as trying to just buy time until you can kind of set up the lock. Cryptic Command being able to bounce again is something that I was interested in.
This seems like it should be a great Supreme Verdict deck. I mean, if you found yourself facing a creature matchup, you know, when they see you play the 3-mana Teferi, like they're going to try to get creatures on the board to get them off the table, and that just plays directly into your Supreme Verdicts, which I think is why you see blue-white just adopting him as a main deck card, as a 2-of. We're not really playing any creatures here that we care about, right? I would maybe look to add a little bit of sweeper potential. The Vapor Snags, I think, if I were going to take this deck through a league, I might just want to put a stronger Isochron hit, like a Thought Scour there. And by stronger, I mean a card that I feel like confident that I can imprint this on an Isochron and get something out of it repeatedly. But the Vapor Snag, it's okay. I don't know. It's certainly worse than Path, and we already have 4 Paths. So I can't imagine myself wanting 3 Vapor Snags. I like the Snapcasters. I think that they have interesting both synergy and not synergy with the Isochron. So Snapcaster, if we're filling our deck with these cheap instants, you know, might as well buy them back with the Snapcaster. But the Isochron is kind of saying we want to like save them, or at least save one. So I guess I'm wondering, like, can we, you know, once we start a game with this, can we just burn the 1-mana instants whenever we have them, like whenever we think they'd be useful? And silence in particular, like, can we afford to cast that, or do we have to just like save that as our Splinter Twin sort of combo piece? You can buy time with, you know, silence, snap silence, make them skip two turns of playing stuff on their main phase, but like at that point you've gone through a silence, it's exiled now, you're not getting it back, and all you have is a snapcaster to show for it, which isn't going to deal them 20. So like if your actual win is Isochron plus silence, like maybe you just have to hold the silence until that time comes, and by extension do you then have to hold the Isochron and not imprint anything else on it besides silence?
Yeah, I agree with Dan that like the Isochron holding that one is the real question. If you have to hold that one, then you don't really need to run cheap instances to run them. You just want to run the silences and then instances that naturally fit into the deck. Or do you think you can actually like feasibly win a game where you just dump in a value Isochron Scepter with a Vapor Snack out? Or is that a game you're going to lose anyway?
Yeah, I mean, these are all reasonable questions. I wouldn't be able to answer that question because no one's ever tried a deck like this. The other thing that Dan was talking about is adding red, you know, you get to play like Lightning Helix and Bolt if you like, and those cards are very effective in certain matchups as just like you're saying, like value hits on your Isochron Scepter. So maybe that's a better way to pursue.
Helix is very interesting. I like that. So that, yeah, like, that's another way to sort of win with the repeated Isochron activations. I was thinking, you were making me think like maybe instead of Vapor Snag, I should imprint something that like a Boomerang or Echoing Truth. So that when the time came, I could bounce the Isochron Scepter itself. Like if I was just sort of stalling for time, I'd put my Boomerang or my Echoing Truth on the Isochron, and then
the one appeal of adding burn is that then you would have out sometimes to like buy enough time with silence to get in, you know, whatever, some amount of damage. You know, you snap, bolt, snap, and then silence, and then snap a bolt. You know, bounce your Snapcaster Mage with Teferi. Try to, you know, steal your way to, you know, 14, 15 damage in certain matchups. That seems a little corner case, though, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I think this deck probably will perform better than I think it will. I think just like the strength of Teferi by himself will go a long way. I'm just like, you know, you can bounce your own Snapcaster Mage and just like you can do all kinds of stuff with Teferi. And I don't actually know how strong the Isochron component of the deck will be. Like I'm kind of wondering if I'll, as I'm playing it, I'll just sort of feel like I just wish those were better control cards, that they don't need the lock necessarily. So I think that's a question I would have if we take this deck through a league. Like, is this just like a win that's complicating the deck?
Yeah, to me it looks a little fragile for my tastes. Isochron Scepter is like awesome when it works, and if they just kind of kill it, you feel really bad. It's a pretty clean 2-for-1 usually when that happens. And then meanwhile, these like silences are just not really a modern level card unless you have the lock ready to go. But who knows? I think it'll be interesting to try it for sure.
Yeah, so I do want to propose one sort of spin-off on this Teferi lockout concept. If we could just move briefly to this third list. Where the idea behind this one, this wasn't, as I was thinking about how I would go about adapting or tweaking the list that you were describing, Dave, if I didn't want to play like the blanks of like silence or, well, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't call them blanks. If I didn't want to play silence, I'll just put it that way, and perhaps not even play Isochron, are there more things I can do with like Teferi's static ability? And it reminded me of like Lavinia, Azorius Renegade, which is a card that we had briefly discussed in our discussion of Restoration Angel in the sort of now lost prequel episode to our podcast, which who knows where that episode will ever get published. But yeah, we talked about sort of like a shell that used Lavinia in conjunction with like Spellqueller and Restoration Angel. And the idea there being that Lavinia has this weird static ability that if anyone casts a spell that they didn't spend any mana on, that spell is countered. And Spellqueller, you know, if they kill the Spellqueller, they get to cast their spell for free, they get the spell back, except if you have Lavinia in play, like now suddenly they just don't get the spell back. So if you happen to assemble those two, Lavinia plus a Spellqueller, now you're sort of free to bounce your own Spellqueller or blink it with a Restoration Angel. And that was something that we sort of kicked around as like, oh, that's kind of interesting. Teferi, I think, can play in like a similar space. Like it just so happens that both Teferi and Lavinia combo with Knowledge Pool, that six-man artifact that I was talking about. If you have either Teferi or Lavinia, a knowledge pool will prevent your opponent from casting any spells, if I'm understanding the rulings correctly. So the list that I'm proposing is more creature-based. We're not playing Isochron or any a heavy spells package. Instead, we're playing like three Lavinia, four Spellqueller, four Teferi, the little Teferi, three Restoration Angel, and then just sort of round out the threat package. So I have Meddling Mage in here, which is a card that, if I've bounced a creature or if I have something under a Spellqueller, I can just like know what I want to name. The other card that I think is interesting here is Delay, which is a weird little counter spell. It's a one and a blue counter target spell, and instead of actually hard countering it, you then exile the spell and it gains suspend 3. So they will eventually get their spell. It will come off suspend in 3 turns. So it buys you some time, but actually if you have Lavinia in play, or Meddling Mage, or Teferi, Delay becomes like a hard counter. Like they just won't get the spell back. So it's kind of like a mishmash of effects like that that all sort of work in the same space of giving your opponent free spells and then preventing them from actually casting their free spells. So what do you guys think of this sort of concept here?
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. It's kind of blue-white, Taxes Hate Bear type shell. It kind of looks like it plays this blue-white tempo game that randomly can just block the opponent out of the game if they make a misstep and they give you an opportunity. I have to think about this a little bit more. What do you think, Dave?
I think that Delay is a little too cute. I really like this. Obviously, we talked about Spellqueller and Lavinia in our sort of pre-run to recording these podcasts, and that was an interaction I thought was really cute. So, I mean, you got me hooked there. You're playing Restoration Angel, so you're preying on my weaknesses. I'm not sure why we wouldn't just play Remand. I mean, I understand that Delay can be a hard counter, but I'd rather just draw the card and then Meddling Mage, whatever they just tried to play. I'm not sure that Delay is necessarily better.
Yeah, I mean, Delay is interesting. Like, it doesn't seem like it's necessarily like the worst card ever if it just, like, you have, it buys you a lot of time to find your counterpart with it. And then sometimes, like, literally 3 turns is kind of a long time.
Yeah, if we had a little faster clock, maybe I'd be a little more interested.
The clock isn't dealing the 20. The clock is assembling Lavinia or Teferi Time Reveler. And yeah, the knowledge pool, like, I don't know how many is the correct number. I just put 2 in. Maybe there should be 4. But that's just such an expensive card that I don't know how many we can afford to play in the main deck with a straight face. But like that is the hard lock that's built into the main deck.
Right. Yeah. I would maybe like to see a V-Click snuck in here, but I like the shell. The V-Click is another legend to work with Mox Amber, which I think is useful. It's also another card that kind of takes advantage of, a Vapor Snag or whatever.
Yeah, I'm curious about... I mean, does this like
more than Reflector Mage? Let's just say that.
Oh yeah, there should probably be Snapcasters in here. I just keep forgetting about that. It's because I don't own Snapcasters on paper, so I just like pretend they don't exist when I'm building decks. Yeah, that's a good one. I'll put a couple in here. Why not? I mean, yeah, I'm not so sure about the Meddling Mage, honestly. So maybe that's just better as Snapcasters.
Yeah, I feel like between 3 Lavinias and 4 Teferis, you already kind of have enough. Tricky cards with Delay and Knowledge Pool that you don't need the Meddling Mage.
Yeah.
I mean, what I like about Meddling Mage is that you can... You don't need those two. You can just play Meddling Mage on something. You Spellqueller their spell, and... Actually, that doesn't work. Never mind. I was thinking you can then blink your Spellqueller once you have the Mage down, and you get the Spellqueller back, because you've already, Meddling Mage there, whatever was hidden under the Spellqueller. Maybe that's just too complicated. I have to actually see this in action to see whether that ever comes up.
I mean, you could just not blink your Spellqueller, and then I still don't have the spell active.
Right.
But I want to blink the Spellqueller to, counter another spell. I want to spend a lot of mana to get a little bit of value and have them
I think Damon is right. I think the concept is good, and we already have 7 of those effects. Lavinia plus Teferi, that's what we need. I'd rather play Snapcaster Mage or Vanillion Click to... I like the idea of actually maybe even sneaking another Mox Amber in there. Because we're getting to play with so many legends. I'm very intrigued by that.
We don't have that many legends. We have 8, right? So it's not a ton of legends. I think it's a cool one of in the sense that you can play Teferi, play Mox Amber, bounce the Mox Amber, and you get 2 mana that turn. So it's almost like Teferi was a one mana play. But I think it's without playing more legends, I wouldn't want to go too hard on Mox Amber. The legend that is missing here is Thalia, Guardian of Thraven. So it's not truly a taxes strategy because Thalia taxes our own Teferis, and I didn't really want to put that in for that reason.
No, I think that's right. She does not belong in this list. You can't play four opt and four path.
And doesn't Thalia also randomly turn off your Lavinia lock?
Does it?
You have to pay for it now.
Oh no. Oh no. Well, thankfully it's not in the deck. Yeah, these are such weird lines of text. I'm sure the mistakes we made.
I'm sure we'll make some more mistakes when we play this.
Yeah. The other tweak that I was considering was instead of playing Knowledge Pool in the main deck, like maybe those are just better as Karns, as the Karn the Great Creator. Like you draw a Karn and you can, you know, if you need a Knowledge Pool, you can immediately, you know, down tick for a Knowledge Pool. Obviously that doesn't work if you were planning to cast a Knowledge Pool immediately. You have to do it the next turn. But yeah, it's just a more versatile card. Like you can put two Karns in the deck, and I'm not sure, like, if you didn't have four Karns, like how much of the sideboard you want to devote to them. So that'll be my hesitation on doing that. But I think like Knowledge Pool is one of those cards that it's a lock piece that I just don't want to have in the main deck. Like I want to never have to draw at an opportune time, even though it's like great situationally with my like more versatile, robust cards like Lavinia or Teferi Time Reveler. So maybe like I think Karn could do something like that if I added two or three copies to this list. I think it would slow down a little bit. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I like that. I don't like Knowledge Pool as a main deck card either. And like we said, Karn can bring you free wins by himself. And it also prompts them to attack. They don't realize that we've got another win that doesn't require Karn to be in play. But, you know, they still kind of have to attack Karn. So I think that's a very reasonable substitution.
Yeah. What I like about this list is it kind of just looks like a blue-white mid-range deck.
Yeah, exactly.
But featuring a little bit of a slight change of card just to give it this kind of prison angle, which really can give that deck a different access to victory that is interesting. And those decks are always pretty fun to play. I kind of just like love playing blue-white mid-range type decks.
Yeah, more fun than prison decks, put it that way.
Yeah.
But maybe they're not as sweet as prison decks, but they're...
Well, they're much, much sweeter.
Okay. All right. So I think, let's see, are there any other lists we want to talk about in the sort of Planeswalker prison space, or should we think ahead about which one of these we want to test going forward?
I think we have kind of three reasonable options to pick from. If it's anything like last week, we might end up at some point trying some or all of these or variations on a theme.
We should mention that there's certainly, the sky's the limit with Planeswalker Prison these days. There's what's called the Pitch Blue deck featuring Narset that I think was popularized by Conley Woods, which basically tries to use Narset, which makes your opponent only able to draw one card a turn, plus cards that make your opponents draw more than one card a turn and then discard a card to make it so that they just have to discard a card. And it also can create a complete game lock where your opponent just never gets to draw a card and they have to just discard immediately in their upkeep.
How does it do that?
So he uses this card. Oh crap, what's the name of it? It's
Lore Broker.
Lore Broker, yeah. So it has one and a blue for a 1/2 tap. Each player draws a card, then discards a card. So if you do that during their upkeep when you have a Narset out, they draw a card, then immediately discard it when they have zero cards in hand. They go to their draw step and they can't draw. And so they really just can't make any forward progress anymore from their draw step. Now the key question is, how do you get them to have zero cards in hand without losing the game first? And the card plays a bunch of pitch spells, such as Disrupting Troll and Commandeer and probably the new Force of Negation once that's released. And so he uses those to stabilize the game before it can get to lockdown. So it looks like a fun deck, certainly is worth trying. It's fun to play these Zoo decks into it because they kind of just beat up on it. The deck really just has trouble answering creatures. Commandeer doesn't do anything there. We played against it once and just kind of smoked it with dragons. It was fun. but certainly worth giving a nice little shout out to that deck. It looks interesting.
Yeah, Dave, I know you love this deck, David. You were on the show.
Oh, I mean, as soon as he said he had a deck with Notion Thief in it, I mean, there's just a big smile on my face. I mean, I will say just philosophically, I actively dislike the Planeswalker type, and I don't like that the modern is becoming all about 3 and 4 mana Planeswalkers. But I think, you know, as a brewer, you have to kind of play with the cards that you're dealt. You can't force, lists that with your pet cards all the time because A, that kind of stagnates your sort of creativity, and B, it's going to lead to real frustration. It's not your job to try to make certain cards work. It's your job to sort of look at the landscape and try to find, you know, interesting or cool interactions. If that is a Teferi, you know, that everyone else is playing, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with trying to make a list around it.
If you hate Planeswalkers, you can always play 9394 Old School.
There you go.
Oh, God.
Or you can play, you know, Hasty Dragons. They look great against these Planeswalkers, like we were saying.
That's true. I mean, Spell when Pierce. Our opponent played Jace, the Mind Sculptor, upticked. When we played Bloodred Elf into Gruul Spellbreaker, that just felt great.
Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah, I want to make a note, mental note, or to just revisit this Narset list. I think, well, yeah, the card, the new Force of Will that was just previewed today, which scares the crap out of me, I think that card is going to make this require, like, some serious scrutiny. It could be too punishing to have that in here. So, but yeah, in the current iterations, I think plenty of people are currently trying to make this deck a little bit better. I think Thing in the Ice is something that I would like to see a way to get that into the deck, because that's a nice one with Days Undoing, but it just it's not currently set up for that, because you can't really cast four spells when you're pitching two cards to cast every spell. But if you could,
I've seen a version with it.
Yeah, I think we played against it.
Might have been good.
Someone was theorizing that was a good combo, and I think he quickly lost against whatever your Wildly Gattles or something like that. So Narset and Teferi, they just seem like they're here to stay. I mean, those are terrifying Planeswalkers. They're kind of frustrating to play against. I guess I know we're running long on time, but I feel compelled to mention this four-color Planeswalker list that Gabriel Nassif had notched a 5-0 with last week. I mean, it's just straight up, it's sweet. I gotta say that. So it's playing...
Exceedingly sweet.
It's exceedingly sweet. It's playing 4 Teferi Time Raveler and 3 Narsets, but then the kill is the Saheeli Rai Felidar Guardian combo, which, you know, from our standard days, that was like the standard legal Splinter Twin. It just so happens that Narset, for whatever reason, can find other Planeswalkers. And there's just like so much synergy built into this deck. I think the way he achieves that is with the card Oath of Nissa, a one mana legendary enchantment, enters the battlefield, you kind of ponder for a Planeswalker or land or a creature. You can get basically any permanent off that. And suddenly, like, if you have that down, every Teferi that you play can just bounce your Oath. Every Felidar Guardian can bounce your Oath. He has Birds and Noble Hierarch to sort of go from 1 mana to 3 mana, because all of his Planeswalkers cost 3. And then just rounding it out, he has some Coiling Oracles as another value thing that you can blink with. You can blink it with Teferi, you can copy it with Saheeli to just like get a little bit of value, you can blink it with the Felidar Guardian. I think this is an extremely clever list. It looks like a brilliant, brilliant deck construction. And I kind of just want to try this one out just to experience it.
I've played against this deck at least once online, at least some variant of it, and it is a little scary to be playing against a Saheeli Rai, just knowing that any time they could top deck Felidar Guardian. I mean, that is actually just a nice little clean combo. And the deck has to play kind of these control elements. You're just drowning against Planeswalkers if you don't get traction immediately. One game I like thought seized my opponent and they had 3 Saheeli Rais and I just kind of buckled in and lost. it's a strong deck.
I think before the new additions, you know, it was kind of a tier 3. I mean, obviously it played the combo element in it, but I think these new Planeswalkers, like you're saying, Dan, they really add a lot. Specifically the interaction of bouncing Oath with Teferi, so you're going up 2 whole cards. I mean, you can just find your combo pieces so fast. Then what are they gonna do? Not attack Teferi? So yeah, I know Nassif's even kind of acted like this is sort of a meme deck. I think this deck is very legitimate. I wouldn't be surprised to see this or some tweaks that he or someone else makes to it, and it becomes a deck that, you know, posts top 8s at relatively large events.
Yeah, I mean, you can go Narset, downtick. If they don't attack it, you downtick again, you play Felidar Guardian, blink it, downtick again.
Yeah.
You just cast 4 impulses. Like, yeah. It's crazy.
And then you find the Oath, which finds, I mean... It's really well constructed. I'm not 100% sold on Nissa Steward of Elements, but I mean, it also plays only good cards.
Right. That's I think the most striking thing. I was trying to like come up with if I was going to iterate on this deck a little bit, like little tweaks. Well, I didn't like Lightning Bolt. I thought that should be Path to Exile, just because it's easier. You can go like a Noble Hierarch on turn one into Saheeli, copy the Noble Hierarch and like cast Path if you have to. Then remands, I don't really see what the remands are for. It made me like think that just based on our discussion of these other Planeswalker locks, like each of these Planeswalkers, Narset, Teferi, like they have like these weird artifacts that you can combo with them to get a lockout. Like Narset, you can lock them out with like a Teferi's Puzzle Box if you wanted to. Teferi, we talked about locking them out with a Knowledge Pool. And like you could just sort of, and Saheeli, you know, before there was Felidar Guardian, there was like this terrible Liquid Metal Coating combo with Saheeli, right? You could, if you had Liquid Metal Coating, you can make anything into an artifact. You can turn Saheeli herself into an artifact, and now she's eligible to copy herself. And you can kind of make infinite Saheelis that way. That doesn't win the game, but if you have a third piece, like an Altar of the Brood, which just mills them for one, then suddenly, like, yeah, you've assembled a three-card kill. And that just made me think, like, we were talking about Liquid Metal Coating, and, you know, Karn can find all of these mismatched artifact pieces. So I think I was wondering if there was some build that's, you know, had all those combo pieces in the sideboard, or possibly even put Liquid Metal Coatings in the main deck. I tried sketching it out. I couldn't quite make the numbers add up. There wasn't quite enough deck space. And so I don't have a battle-ready list of that to play. And it doesn't pass the bar you were saying, Dave, of playing only good cards. But it plays sweet cards. It plays a lot of sweet Planeswalker Fun Police combos with Karn to sort of tie it all together with this sort of terrible artifact Prison Wishboard, and then a Liquid Metal Coating just chilling in the main deck. Something to think about.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we've only started to tap the potential of some of these Planeswalkers. Three mana Planeswalkers in general are very powerful. The ability to play them on turn two with a mana guy, you know, is even more powerful. And having static abilities, we're seeing their effects right now. I guess time will tell if that was a mistake or not. I think we're maybe seeing that these cards are powerful enough that they may become dominant in Modern. That would not surprise me.
Yeah, sometimes it feels like within, if the meta didn't have new cards introduced over the next 6 months, it would become a two-deck meta featuring humans versus like four-color Karn, Saheeli, Narset, Teferi, Walker, Prison. It's like the only two tier zero decks.
So I think, well, let's wrap it up with these lists and maybe just a closing thought. What are you thinking you might want to test sometime this week? Any thoughts, Damon?
I like the Teferi Lavinia lockout just because I kind of like the blue-white beats plan. I mean, I'm skeptical that the combo pieces will truly be that effective, but I'm definitely curious to see how delay works as a two-mana counterspell. And then I do kind of like the idea of playing that Jund deck that just kind of gets a lot of value. It looks fun to play.
Yeah, I look forward to casting some Kolaghan's Commands. I just love that card, so I might try that. And if I have time, I'd try each of the other leagues, other decks maybe once, and we'll see what speaks to me. And David, what are you thinking?
I actually like the Lavinia lock list the most because it plays a bunch of cards that don't require the lock that I love, which, I mean, Restoration Angel is just better than all the other cards we've been discussing. but yeah, like you say, I'll probably get in some games with all of them. I think the two white blue lists are sort of unique enough that you need to figure out how many of each piece you even want. Do you just want like some corner case times when you want to play the Scepter, for instance? Maybe you don't, that shouldn't even be a four of. Yeah, can you load it up with Lightning Helixes and stuff like that so you can just play it as a value plan? That's all stuff you can only find out by actually, you know, playing a bunch of games and seeing how it feels. But yeah, that's the beautiful part. You sketch out lists and, you know, you get lots of feedback from, you know, great players like you guys, and then you just kick it around and see if there's anything there. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. This is the fun part. You get to find out for real.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Definitely. Well, we are going to be recording another podcast this week. Dan and I are taking some extended time off over Memorial Day, so there won't be any reactions to the spoilers that have started to drop or anything like that. And we won't have sort of results on these lists for another 10, 12 days, something like that. But we'll come back with some fresh lists to talk over. And maybe at the end of the 2 weeks, we'll have a lot of feedback on a bunch of different brews.
Absolutely.
All right, gentlemen. Take care. Easy.
Take care.
See you guys.
That'll do it for episode 4 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. All of the decks that we discussed today are posted in the show notes. We are a brand new podcast, and we would love to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG, or join the discussion of today's episode on the Modern subreddit at r/ModernMagic. So, give us your feedback, give us a follow, tell a friend, and we'll see you next week.